This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
In early 2023, this programme told you about an outbreak of avian flu that was killing millions of birds around the world and a lot of seals. Flash forward a year, and that virus, known as H5N1, was discovered in farms across America, and we now know it's been passing between cows. And as we learn from COVID, what happens in Animal Vegas doesn't always stay in Animal Vegas. So what do scientists make of this recent development in America? What, if anything, can be done about it? How much should we worry? And if things do get worse, how prepared are we? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start with the basics. Professor Wendy Barclay is the Action Medical Research Chair in Virology at Imperial College London. Wendy Barclay, last time you appeared on the programme, you told us that almost all flus start as bird flu. Why is that?
Flu is caused by this virus, influenza virus. It's a really happy virus, if you like, inside birds. It's where all flu began, we think. And there are many, many different flavours of the virus in wild birds like ducks and geese all over the world. Viruses are parasites. They live inside hosts. They adapt to their particular hosts. And this virus is really well adapted to living inside birds.
So did the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918-19, not that I want to panic anybody, but did it start in birds?
It certainly came originally from birds. There's quite a lot of debate, actually, whether or not it did or didn't go through what we call an intermediate species, such as a pig, before jumping into humans. But certainly if you trace it back to its roots, it was a bird virus in the beginning.
And how does it then spread to other species? How does it spread to mammals?
Well, birds obviously, you know, in their ecology do have contact with other mammals, both in the wild, but more importantly, when we farm animals, wild birds like ducks have the opportunity to share space and water with them. And actually in birds, flu is a disease which replicates inside their gut and it's shed out into water.
Does it have to do any mutation in order to make that change? Or is the simple, the virus as it was in the bird is transmitted to the mammal?
Well, the virus from the bird transmits into the mammal, but if it doesn't mutate, it will probably be what we call a dead end, because the virus is not yet adapted to the new host, the mammal, and there are all sorts of mismatches, incompatibilities between the bird virus and the mammal host. But flu, as you will know, is a highly mutable virus. It can mutate really quickly. And when it finds itself inside a new host, a whole bunch of variants will arise. And one of those just might be better inside the mammal than the bird virus was originally. And that's the one that will grow out very rapidly. So that's how come humans have flu, because although it was once a bird virus, it has been selected over generations of evolution to transform into a virus which is much happier inside a human cell than a bird cell.
But what is it about the structure of a flu virus that makes it that way as opposed to other viruses?
Flu's got two different ways of mutating or acquiring that transformative change to switch from a virus of one host to another. The first is shared with all viruses, particularly the viruses whose genomes are made of RNA. So that means that they can really vary very quickly. As they replicate themselves, actually what they do is they make all kinds of mistakes. And some of those mistakes are bad news for the virus. They render the virus dead. But others give it that little edge. They make it better than all its siblings. And those mistakes are the mutations which grow out. All viruses can do that. But the other thing about flu is that its genetic material is spread into 8 discrete pieces that we call the segments. And if 2 different flu viruses get inside the same animal, the different segments from each of them can mix up in different combinations. You can call this viral sex, if you like. It's got 2 parents, a mother and a father, if you like, and the progeny is the combination of the two. And some of those progeny, some of those children of the 2 viruses are actually now a combination which has got all the right bits for replicating inside a mammal, but perhaps now look different to our immune system in a way that we've never seen before. And that's what happens when we get these explosive pandemics, which can then emerge into humans because we've got a virus to which nobody has got any pre-existing immunity.
Let's talk about the history of this strain of bird flu, which, as we discussed before, is called H5N1. Can you tell us a bit about how it came about and when we first really became aware of it being a problem?
H5N1 is just one of, 16 or so different flavours of bird flu. The H5N1 always raises alarm because we know it can become highly pathogenic. So there are certain mutations which can happen in its HA gene, in the H5 piece of it, which allow the virus to spread through the body of an infected animal in a much more sort of virulent way than bird flu normally does. So I've said that normal bird flus are replicating in the guts of the birds and shed out into the water. But if a chicken, for example, gets infected with an H5 highly pathogenic virus, then you actually find the virus spreads all through the body, into the brain, into all the different organs of the body, and the birds die very quickly. And this particular lineage of H5N1, the highly pathogenic sort, was noticed in Hong Kong and China around about the late 1990s, 1996. And then in 1997, there were some reports, very unusually, of humans becoming infected with H5N1 in what we call the wet markets, where people go and buy their live birds so that they're nice and fresh when they want to eat them. Since then, this H5N1 highly pathogenic virus has continued to mutate. Where we are today is that the H5N1s that exploded around the world about 3 or 4 years ago are derived from those H5N1s which were seen in the Chinese poultry markets back in the late 1990s, but they are now different. They are mutant versions of those original strains.
Is this strain, H5N1, fatal for birds or mammals if they get it?
Well, it's certainly fatal for chickens. These highly pathogenic H5 viruses will kill all the birds in a flock. And indeed, last year in the United States, they were still in the throes of these H5N1 outbreaks and seeing huge numbers of birds dying in their poultry farms. We here in Europe and the UK experienced that about a year earlier. Mammals, again, are what we've seen with these recent H5N1s that have the snappy name clade 2344b. What we've seen with these is that certain wild mammals that have scavenged on wild birds that have died from this virus have also been fatally infected. So foxes, otters, and also sea mammals who have picked up dead birds from the water and then eaten them, they end up dying.
How is it fatal? I mean, what actually kills them?
For the birds, you find the virus all the way through their body. So it's basically complete organ failure. For the mammals, when they're scavenging on these wild birds, it's probably that the virus goes straight back into their brain, because as they're eating the dead carcass, they can inhale virus into their olfactory systems, and there is a route from there back to the brain. And once you've got virus in the brain, which is not being restricted very well, that will be fatal. The virus is very virulent inside these animals.
Wendy Barclay. Armed with that information, I want to know more about what's been happening on farms in America. Joining me now are Kai Kupfer-Schmidt, science journalist and molecular biologist, and Dr. Caitlin Rivers, epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Caitlin Rivers, when did the virus first appear in cows, and how widespread has it become?
We first recognized the problems in cows in March of this year. And currently there are 46 affected herds in 9 states. So quite a lot has happened over the last 2 months and more ahead, I think.
Right. And how did the virus get into cows, do we know?
Well, the virus has been circulating in wild birds for several years now, actually. It first reached North America in 2021. And so what likely happened is that there was some natural contact between the wild birds and the cattle. Maybe there was a dead bird on the premise, or maybe somehow contaminants from the bird entered the feed. We don't know the exact scenario, but what's clear is that there has been this jump from birds to cows. It's spreading between cows. And so that's really changed the nature of the problem from one that's primarily centered in those wild birds to one that is really reaching across the United States.
Kai, can you take us through how this has been detected and how the detection has been handled? It seems like a huge surprise and to have come out of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's a surprise in several ways. Like, first of all, we've known that very occasionally cattle can get infected with influenza A, but this is not normally something that you see. There's another type of influenza, influenza D, that usually infects cattle. And so what happened was that in January, some farmers realized that the milk cows in the herds were, some of them at least, were giving less milk. Sometimes the milk was a little kind of yellowish and denser, a little bit like colostrum. And in the beginning, they weren't sure what this was. And so it took quite a while, because nobody really had H5N1 on their list of possibilities. It took a while until researchers also tested for influenza A and then realized, wow, it's avian influenza in these herds. So we think that the virus probably jumped into cattle maybe late last year, maybe very early this year. And of course, we only really learned about it towards the end of March. So there was a long stretch where this virus was really spreading under our radar without us knowing, which, when you think about the fact that this is an animal that produces food for humans, it's kind of striking that we would be caught that unaware.
We'll discuss that a little bit in a bit more depth in a moment, how that happens. But one of the things, Caitlin, that strikes one immediately about this is you can see why individual cows might get this from maybe drinking water that has been polluted by, infected by birds. But how could it pass between cattle themselves?
Yeah, that's really still under investigation, and so our thinking may change. But right now, it seems like the milking equipment may be one of the ways that cows are spreading the virus between each other. So there is shared equipment in dairies, and the cows are sort of moved through, milked, and then the next cow is introduced into the equipment. Scientists are finding very high levels of virus in milk, and so that's why the milking equipment seems like it might be playing a role.
And is that because the place where the virus manifests itself in cattle is actually in the udders rather than, say, any other part of the cow?
Yes, right now it seems like the tropism, or the propensity of the virus to infect certain parts of the body, it's really favoring mammary tissue. So scientists are finding very high levels of virus in the mammary tissue of the cows, in the milk, and so likely the milk is playing a role in that transmission. Now, the other important way that the virus is spreading between states seems to be the movement of cows across state lines. So they're sold to another farm, they're transported to another state, and that is how the virus seems to be being introduced to new herds.
Kai, that brings up the question of how well this is reported and detected in the American system. We've had big experience of this over here in Britain 25 years ago. What would you say about that?
Maybe just to add one thing, one of the things that I've learned reporting this is that in winter in the US, a lot of cows are sent to kind of the southern states. And then as the prairies become green again earlier in the year, they move back up north. And so one of the hypotheses is that the way that the virus was being spread was because these cattle were basically moving or being sent back north. And that's where it's kind of interesting. There's very little reporting or surveillance in the US in terms of the cattle movement. So what we have in Europe because of the BSE crisis is the system where basically each cow is tagged and you can look up exactly where the cow was at what point. That doesn't really exist in the US. So that from the get-go is kind of a hindrance when you're trying to understand what exactly happened in these months where you didn't even know this virus was spreading. And now in the current situation, what you really need is you need access to these farms, because what you want to understand is, okay, how many cows in a herd that is affected actually are symptomatic? How many cows that don't show any symptoms but had the infection? So you'd have to look for antibodies in the blood for that, which is called serology. So what you really want to do is to have serology on all the cows in the herd. You want to, you know, investigate the people working on the farm. Do they have antibodies? Did some of them have symptoms? And so for all of these things, you need access to the farms. And that's really been an issue in the US. We are still flying blind to a large extent. There's a lot of questions that 2 months into knowing about this outbreak and possibly 5 months into this outbreak, we really should know a little bit more and have a bit more data.
Caitlin, that's astonishing. I mean, it's astonishing to a British audience who knows that here you certainly do have the powers to go into a farm and insist on testing and insist on getting samples.
Yes, it is. I couldn't agree more with Kai that there are a lot of blind spots right now in the way that we're able to understand where the virus is and how it's moving. There was a new federal order instituted just recently requiring testing for cows moving across state lines. So that's one step in the right direction of understanding, really getting our arms around this problem. But it does leave a lot of gaps with cows that are already resident in certain states. Now, we have to remember that these dairies are businesses. These are important drivers of the U.S. economy. They are important for the people who own the businesses and work there. And I think we're really starting to see, again, the intersection of the economy and public health and the ways that they're really inextricable and have to be accommodated and thought through on both sides.
I remember during COVID that one of the ways in which you discovered whether or not there was a degree of prevalence of the virus was simply looking at wastewater being tested. Is that happening? And if so, is H5N1 turning up?
There have been some preliminary results showing that there is H5N1 genetic material in wastewater. So I think this is going to be one of the situations where the wastewater monitoring might really play a big role. I think we're only starting to really use it. You can imagine a scenario where you're not only looking at the virus in the wastewater to understand where it is or how prevalent it is, but even trying to sequence the virus out of the wastewater. So basically taking these snippets of virus, putting them together, sequencing them, and that way kind of like having surveillance on how the virus is changing even. I think people are looking at that given the difficulties with the farms. But I do want to emphasize, I think we have seen this in a lot of other outbreaks, and public health has a lot to do with, you know, human interactions and with communities. And we have learned in other diseases that we really need to build trust with communities. If you talk about something like Mpox in the gay community, for instance, like we know that we have to go to these places, talk to people, you know, really understand their concerns, their worries. People want to be healthy and want to help other people be healthy. But at the same time, of course, there are fears and worries about their own livelihoods. And so I think this really shows that when we talk about One Health, this idea that animal health and human health can't really be separated, we have to work on both. I think that means that these communities all have to talk to each other, have to be taken seriously. And so, yes, there are workarounds. I think the wastewater is going to play a role, but I really think it shouldn't distract us from the fact that we need to engage with these communities, because in the long run, how you stop this from occurring in the first place is by having these kinds of conversations that are, you know, mutually beneficial, hopefully.
Caitlin, can we look at the virus itself for a moment and talk about what we know about how the virus has changed, and if it has changed, how it's changed?
Sure. This is one of the big open questions. Influenza has always been regarded by epidemiologists as one of the possible sources of the next pandemic. Now, H5N1 is currently only in animals. It's only in wild birds, now in cattle, and sometimes spilling over into other mammals. But the reason that we're so keen to track this event closely is because we fear that it will adapt to become better suited for humans. Now, right now, there are very small indicators that may be happening. There was one mutation in the human case that has been associated with better adaptation to humans, but we're really not seeing widespread markers of human adaptation like we fear. So it's something that scientists will need to continue to monitor and continue to analyze. But right now, I think that we're not seeing those red flags going up. But that it's certainly possible that that will change.
I suppose the immediate question the listener might have is, if it can happen in one person, why shouldn't it happen in many people?
The mutation that was found in the one human case made it better adapted to mammalian cells, but there's actually a number of mutations that need to happen in order for the virus to infect humans easily and then to spread between humans easily. The other thing to note is that we're not seeing that specific mutation or any of the other super concerning mutations in cows. And so it could be that the virus changed in that one human, but as long as that human didn't pass the virus on to other humans, then it's sort of a dead end situation.
Kai, that's one of the really interesting aspects about viruses, which is that they actually can have individual mutations. But are you, as somebody who has followed this for quite a long time, do you have any kind of significant worry about the potential of this to become something which is passed to humans and then conceivably mutates to pass between them?
I do. And, you know, this is a virus that the public health community has been concerned about ever since it first infected humans, I think, in Hong Kong 27 years ago. Scientists have been watching this virus, and it feels like it's just been, you know, this slow motion towards a pandemic, because it has been inching closer and closer. And like Caitlin says, there are a number of mutations that are needed. It's important to remember that H5N1 actually, you know, out of all of the influenza viruses that we know, the avian influenza viruses, actually has quite big hurdles to becoming a good human pathogen. But at the same time, if it's given enough chances, then even very unlikely things are likely to happen, right? And I think that's what we're seeing. I don't think we will be in an H5N1 pandemic next week or next month. But first of all, I think we're certainly not moving away from that scenario. I mean, like I said, this virus has been inching closer and closer to humans. It's gone from birds in Southeast Asia to birds around the world to occasional mammal cases to now a situation where it seems pretty comfortable in a mammal that has a lot of human interactions and that we use to produce food. And secondly, the reason we are not in a pandemic has nothing to do with us humans reacting appropriately in this situation. I think it's only because the virus so far seems pretty bad at infecting humans. So in some ways, we are at the mercy of this virus's capabilities to change. And if there is even a tiny chance that this virus can get much better at spreading human to human, then looking at how we are handling the situation, I think we will find out. And that's what worries me the most, is that it just showcases how bad we are at actually preventing something that is preventable.
Caitlin Rivers, what do you think about that?
Although my concern over H5N1 becoming a pandemic right now is low, as a mom and as a community member, I'm not particularly worried. I could not agree more with Kai that over the long term, I do worry about this virus and other influenza viruses like it. H5N1 has infected humans in the past. Around 900 humans have been infected over the last 30 or so years. And about half of those have died. And so there are some outstanding questions about what the pathology is in humans, and how much of that very high mortality rate is because there are a lot more human infections that were never found. That's always an open question when it comes to these emerging infectious diseases. We are giving H5N1 a lot of opportunities to try new things. And if it goes on long enough, it's very possible that the virus will hit on a combination that makes it well suited to humans. And I think it's our responsibility to do everything we can to prevent that from happening, which means better understanding what's happening in cows, increasing our surveillance in humans so that we can monitor how things are going, watching for those mutations, and really making sure that we're giving this situation our all. Now, the best possible thing is that nothing will happen and we'll look back and say, what was all that for? But we have to remember in public health that the goal really is to make nothing happen. And we need to celebrate when that is what we achieve and not kind of write it off as something where we overreacted.
Caitlin Rivers there with Kai Kupfer-Schmidt. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one asking whether this is the Saudi century, the one about the threat that China poses to the UK, and the one about the water industry in Britain. Back to avian flu. And now I want to understand how prepared the UK is should it appear in cattle here. Professor Ian Brown leads the Avian Virology Group at the Pirbright Institute. Ian Brown, we heard earlier that testing of cattle in the UK and Europe is much better than it is in the United States. Does that mean there's less need for us to worry about things here?
Well, to put it in context, so far, this influenza infection in cattle has only been described in dairy animals in the US with a particular strain that's not present in Europe. However, we do have very strong animal health systems that are designed to track and monitor changes in disease trends. So something like milk drop, which has been reported in these cattle, if there were substantive changes in that, that wouldn't have gone under the radar of recognition and would probably have been followed up.
Are authorities in the UK taking the US outbreak seriously, as far as you know? Are there kind of eyes on it?
Yeah, there's a substantial cross-government response looking at all manifestations. So the risk of importation and food safety, the potential consequences and impact if the infection was to arrive here, and what is the level of preparedness, both from a veterinary and a public health perspective. And of course, we already have a very strong underpinning monitoring system in wild birds in the UK, which has been in place for several years now, to do exactly this, track new strains of influenza. Of course, the game changer would be, well, if that virus was to find its way into the UK and then find its way into cattle herds. And of course, it's around doing the preparedness, working with the industry and all stakeholders to ensure that you have a good early warning system.
Right. And what would that consist of here?
Well, that would consist of an algorithm for reporting infection or suspected infection in dairy cattle. What we should be clear is it's quite unusual, this particular manifestation, because it's only in lactating dairy animals that we've seen the disease so far. And therefore, it's got a very precise way of spreading and a very limited way of spreading, which is quite good news. If the virus had a respiratory tropism, that would, of course, be a bigger challenge. But at the minute, the initial data from the US colleagues is that this virus actually is happier in the mammary gland of the cattle rather than in the respiratory tract, which is good because generally these viruses spread very efficiently through the air on droplets, which means they have to be an upper respiratory tract infection to do that.
I'm just wondering something about a big trade-off here. On the one hand, is it possible that we have increasingly created the conditions for viral mutation that can be problematic for us? But on the other hand, we have also been much more active on creating the conditions for combating what happens when those viruses mutate in a bad way.
Well, it's an interesting balance, isn't it? So you're absolutely right. COVID has given us a great leap forward in terms of new tools and technologies to combat fast-moving infectious diseases. So absolutely, we're in a technological age where we can develop more effective tools much more quickly. On the flip side, of course, we've got a group of viruses here now, these high pathogenicity H5 serotype viruses that have acquired a very successful niche in that they've been able to infect a greater range of wildlife species, which has led to greater environmental contamination, greater global spread. And as a result of that, that virus has found its way into domestic livestock species. Now, of course, traditionally, that has been poultry. And we know that poultry around the world have unfortunately been afflicted by this particular virus. But with such a high level of efficiency and so much virus out there, it's created opportunities for exposure of other hosts that perhaps normally wouldn't be exposed to the virus.
Where do you understand us to be right now with vaccine preparedness for H5N1? I suppose in the first instance, we're talking about four animals, but I suppose in the longer term, you're thinking about planning for any possible transmission amongst humans.
Well, of course, there is a very well tried and tested system under the auspices of the World Health Organization, which meets twice a year to look at emerging strains of influenza virus, including those from animals, that in the future could acquire an ability to infect and spread amongst people. So they're what we call candidate vaccine strains. And to date, although it's early days, the initial data would indicate that there are candidate vaccine strains that do indeed match to these strains that have been to cattle.
Ian Brown. My thanks to him and to Wendy Barclay, Caitlin Rivers and Kai Kupferschmidt. My conclusion is testing, testing, testing. The Briefing Room will be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Sally Abrahams and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by Rod Farker. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Look at this. I found a secret room, and it's behind a trapdoor.
We're looking for someone who controls one of the largest gangs of people smugglers. He calls himself Scorpion.
The top one? Impossible you can find them.
His gang has made millions from people coming to the UK in small boats.
This was so cold. So cold, I wanna die.
Finding him won't be easy, and it will be dangerous.
Oh, we need to get out of here. So get in the car.
I'm Sue Mitchell, and this is Intrigue, to catch a scorpion from BBC Radio 4. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.